Welcome to Books and Beyond with your host, Alison. Join us for half an hour of information, entertainment, reading recommendations, and beyond. Brought to you by Auckland Libraries.
I know this girl.
No mai, haere mai, kia ora, and welcome to Books and Beyond Literary Lounge with Alison and Enika, brought to you from our home studios. Kia ora, Enika.
Kia ora, Alison.
Well, look, in the news over the last week, the 2021 Booker Prize for Fiction has been announced, and the prize was awarded then to Damon Galgut for his novel The Promise, which carried a prize fund of £50,000, which is not a bad little earner for that. So huge congratulations to Damon.
Absolutely. And he's been, I think, shortlisted a couple of times or longlisted. So, yeah, wonderful that he is in the top share. Now, of course, when it was announced, it went straight to the top of Auckland Library's most requested list. So, you may be waiting a little while to read it, but I know I'm somewhere in the middle. I'm so looking forward to reading this one.
Me too. Yeah, I think I'm close to the bottom of the list, but that is absolutely okay. But it's
nice,
going to be
nice end to the Booker's dozen, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So what have you been reading this week, Enika?
Ah, well, this one I actually read a few weeks ago, but I've been looking forward to talking to you about it. It's called Cultish, The Language of Fanaticism by Amanda Montell. And it's a nonfiction book that was published just this year. It's available in ebook and e-audio book as well. Now, you might recall, if you're a regular listener, that I reviewed Amanda Montell's first book, which was called Word Slut, A Feminist Guide to Taking Back the English Language, last year. Now, that one looked at how the patriarchy is sort of baked into communication of all types of forms and, more importantly, how to get rid of it and how to notice it and cut it down when you hear it. So in this second book, which is really, really timely, Cultish, she's tracing the shared linguistic patterns and lexicon of cults, and also what she calls the cultish or the cult adjacent. So she starts with what you call probably your classic cults. She looks at the language used by sort of suicide cult leaders like Jonestown's infamous Jim Jones, you know, who was such an amazing orator and of course had this very manipulative language that ended up in everybody drinking the Kool-Aid, whatever other raro type drink it ended up being. And then she goes on a bit deeper. She goes into pseudo-religions such as Scientology. She looks at multi-level marketing companies. She looks at fitness franchises, which you might not think of as a cult, but she puts a pretty good case forward for that, certain ones. And even influential social media gurus. So you can see from this that she draws a very wide circle in her definition of cultish, but she does make a really good case, I think. She really is looking for those organizations that are making bank really out of well-being and also that constant push to reach to be the best you that you can be. You know, she's looking for cultish language and vocabulary in the cultures of fitness outfits such as CrossFit, SoulCycle, Bikram Yoga. You know, all of these have come up and down in popularity over the years, mostly coming out of the US. And she does have a US focus in this book. She's also looking at multi-level marketers, what I would call wellness products / dream purveyors, you know, more recent ones. So she does look at the history of those like Amway and Tupperware, but she's looking more specifically at the more recent ones like Arbonne and LuLaRoe leggings, which is one that I don't know, I haven't really seen that here, but apparently that's like a subscription legging kind of jobby.
Goodness me.
I know.
Yes.
The things you can sell to people.
When will it end? Yes.
Well, she really interestingly puts it all into the those organizations as taking up space where formal religion used to sit for many people. And sort of filling a vacuum and a void in people's lives. So quite interesting. She looks at Instagram spiritual gurus and natural living, that kind of natural living ethos, and how that kind of slams up against freedom of choice and then how close it can get to QAnon, anti-vax, and that sort of conspirituality, as she calls it.
So conspiracy. Very, very Interesting. And quite current, really, topical, isn't it?
Very, very topical. Very topical. And she's got her own sort of skin in the game as well. So she lives in California, so she's really close to what I would call the cult epicenter. Her own grandparents were actually members of a notorious Californian cult called Synanon, and her father managed to escape from their clutches when he was 17. He was very bright guy and kind of like had a little bridge to get out. But she's also discussing as well just how attractive and appealing that those sorts of organizations or communities can sound through their language and how they can appear. And she looks at it in terms of, particularly in terms of types of upheaval, when life and society is being shaken up and communities might be divided or on either sides of arguments. Yeah, so she sees it as sort of ripe. It's a time, particularly now, which is ripe for this kind of thing to come in and have influence. So very, very timely. Now, I read this probably, I would say actually this might be more than a month ago now. It did spark me into a deep dive into all things cult. Netflix is a great place to go and find some great cultish documentaries. And, of course, there's so many podcasts out there about cults and other books too. Certainly it made me, I did think about this book again when, you know, seeing the anti-vax and anti-government protests going on this week, but getting a bit more loud and visible. This book's really a good reminder of the real power of language and how the words and the rhetoric and the references we use can have such far-reaching effects, and that can be for good or for ill. It can be intentional or it can be unintentional. Yeah, we just need to think carefully about the words we use, and
That's really, really interesting. And I was thinking, especially because we are living in such an uncertain age, and you know, people are vulnerable, and people are searching often for either the answer or, you know, maybe if I wear those leggings, I'll, you know, my life will change. Or, or often it's starting a particular diet. If I eat like the caveman ate, you know, do that for a year, then life will change. And, it's very, very interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, highly recommend this one.
I'm going to look into that. Thanks so much for that. Do you know, it sort of segues beautifully, and this was unintentional actually, into something that I just read, which I really enjoyed. So if we go from cults to corporate America, which has its own cult-like aspects, particularly in this book, this amazing novel that I've just finished, it's called Black Buck, and it's just published just in the last couple of months, and it's available in the adult fiction section of the libraries. So Black Buck is a debut novel by a 29-year-old writer from Brooklyn, New York, and his name is Mateo Ascaripor. Black Buck, it's a New York Times bestseller, and it's received rave reviews. It's a biting satire about capitalism and race in the USA. And interestingly, it's been compared to classics of the genre such as, remember that film Sorry to Bother You by Boots Riley? And then perhaps more well-known, the Jordan Belfort memoir, The Wolf of Wall Street. Which was made into the well-known film. So now, one thing I love about it is it's a coming-of-age novel, which is kind of my thing. And it's quite irresistible. But it's interesting. It's presented as a self-help manual, which is very current as well. So our narrator, the narrator of the book, Darren, tells us, "I am a black man on a mission." No, I am a black salesman on a mission. And so Darren's writing from his penthouse, so I'll put that in inverted commas, but it is a penthouse, overlooking Central Park, beautiful view. And Darren says that he wants only to give other black people the tools they need to fulfill their dreams. He's an ambitious black man who's always working in two registers in life. It's very interesting. Mm. He's one in one, he's playing along and, you know, as the dutiful and polite Black American. Mm. And the other one, he's playing the long game. Mm. He knows that his quest to conquer corporate America is a marathon. It's not a sprint. And it's a game. So the books, as well as this really interesting story and fast-paced story, it's full of side notes such as, reader, watch closely and take notes. Sales isn't about talent. It's about overcoming obstacles, beginning with yourself. So there's lots of sort of bits of kind of down-home advice. But you're not quite sure if he's sincere or if he's just, if this is just a massive parody.
Right.
But Darren says, every day is deals day. It sort of does sound a bit cultish, doesn't it? So now we're introduced at the beginning of the book to our narrator, Darren. He's young, gifted and black, and he's 22, and he's pretty much content with his life as a barista at a busy Manhattan Starbucks franchise. So, and he's got a lovely long-term girlfriend called Soraya, and she's the child of immigrants from the Middle East. And Darren's mother, who he lives with, she's worked her whole life in a factory, and she thinks that Darren should be aiming higher and doing justice to his talents and abilities, which you can understand. Now, one of the regular customers at the Starbucks shop, cafe, is the CEO of a tech startup, and he sees Darren's potential. So the CEO, whose name is Rhett, I keep thinking Rhett Butler, but Rhett becomes determined that Darren should come and work for him on his sales team, and Darren eventually agrees. So, and now what is interesting, you never really get truly work out what they are actually selling, which sort of reminds me of a cult too, because it turns out they're selling a dream, basically, of wellness. But so Darren, he leaves Starbucks and he joins this all-white, ambitious sales team who are horribly racist and aggressive. And the startup has a ruthless dog-eat-dog culture. And Darren, poor old Darren, undergoes an absolute week of hell training in this hostile environment. And so the management at the startup, they rename him Buck because of his Starbucks association. So while treating him horribly, they quickly begin to exploit him as the face of diversity for the company. Mm. You know, so they want stuff from him, but then, you know, it's a hard trade for him. Mm. So Buck changes his entire personality to succeed at sales, and he shapes a new identity, transforming himself into becoming a sort of single-minded, money-driven, sort of coke sniffing, that's not the right word, is it? And he becomes sort of someone that his family and his friend, they no longer recognize. Mm. So his girlfriend is saying, what's happened to you? You know, his mom, the lodger in their house. It becomes quite a crisis. And then a tragedy unfolds. And so this crisis then leads back to an initiative to help and advise other people of colour to enter and hopefully thrive in the American corporate world. So it's quite interesting. And so then some people accuse Buck of starting a cult himself. So It all gets very interesting and very, it sort of reads like a thriller, actually. Mm. So it's powerful, it's well written. I found it profound and very thought-provoking. As I said, full of twists and turns, very pacey. And it really portrays many of those sort of ghastly reasons why America struggles when it comes to employing a diverse workforce. Mm. And all the, you see all the cultural appropriation, the microaggressions, overt racism that you could imagine. I've got to be honest, it was a difficult read for me at times. It's quite confronting, but it's one of those ones that white folks should read, I think, because it could not be more relevant in our world than it is today. And, you know, if I was a high school English teacher, I would definitely assign this to my class because there's so much to unpack.
Sounds so juicy, yeah.
It's good. Yeah. It's a good one.
Reminds me a bit, it sounds a little bit like The Sellout and a little, and you know, yes. Some of the same themes.
Actually, that's a really good point. Yeah. I hadn't thought of that, but I know what you're saying.
Which I love that book. Oh, so
yes.
Good. Oh, well, my one is a bit different from that. It is a, a bestseller, definitely. So I just whipped through Malibu Rising by Taylor Jenkins Reid, and that was published this year, 2021. It's available in adult fiction and as an Overdrive ebook. So you may have heard of this one. Taylor Jenkins Reid profile has been going up and up and up in the last few years. She's got a lot of stories under her belt. This is I think probably her biggest to date. So the main story of Malibu Rising is set in California in 1983, over 24 hours on the night of the party of the year. So it's held every August, so in the mid to end summer in the US at Nina Riva's place. It's an insider's do. It gets bigger every year. There's Hollywood movie producers, there's Brat Packers, rock stars, DJs, drug dealers, models, local wannabes, all in the mix and in the pool and also in the spa with, you know, not one but two members of a Brit synth band that very closely resembles Duran Duran. So this is a saucy novel.
Oh, yes. Very enticing.
So Nina is the eldest of four adult siblings and they're from a famous family. So the dad is Mick Riva, who's a singer who fell in love with their mum June when he came to Malibu in the 60s. Then he hit the big time as a pop star. Now, he still loves her, but he can't really turn a blind eye to the ladies when he's out on tour. I mean, that's a common story, isn't it?
Yep.
So Mick is carrying on with multiple women while the family and the kids are all carrying on back home in Malibu without him. Now, Mum June is strong for her kids and she's holding it together while he's away. But when he leaves for good this time, it does push her over the edge. And the oldest daughter, Nina, has to step up while she's still a kid herself. She's caring for everyone, including Mum. And she ends up leaving high school to take on work to make money for the family. So she starts by overseeing the family's seafood restaurant. She then goes on to become a competitive surfer. And then she's discovered as a rising star model, sort of like Cheryl Teagues, if you remember her.
Yeah.
I'm sure we all do. Absolutely beautiful.
Yes.
Now, don't ask me how she manages to fit all of these jobs in, but it does work in with the wider plot, I guess. Now, her next brother down, Jay, is also a world-class surfer. Next one is Hud. He's a photographer who specializes in surf shoots. And there's kid sister Kit. She's 18. She's trying to get out from under her kind of siblings' shadows, but she's not sure if she's herself ready for the spotlight yet or a boyfriend, importantly, in the plot. Now, they're all, of course, hot, gorgeous. There's all these ex-current and prospective partners in the mix too. Now, every second chapter, you go back in time to find out more of the Riva family backstory and how they all got to this one night in 1983. You see Malibu grow from this rustic beachside community into what's becoming a sort of newly minted playground for the rich and famous. Now, if you know the song Boys of Summer by Don Henley, this book is, you'll be hearing that in your head. You know,
it's got, I love that song, actually.
It's so evocative, yeah. So it's got the, you know, the sunnies and the tan, the jeans, the sun-bleached hair and the whiff of the coconut oil and, of course, the beach. Now, the party at the heart of the book is this total mess of beautiful people and music and cocaine and pash-ups and fisticuffs. And it's really just the ticket for if you've been stuck in lockdown and it's been boring as hell, yeah.
Oh, that sounds fabulous. Just pure escapism. It's what we need at the moment,
exactly,
isn't it?
Exactly what it is. It is pure escapism. Now, I really loved Daisy Jones and the Six, which was her last book. Her three most recent releases have all been set in California. So we've got The Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo in 60s Hollywood. Daisy Jones is kind of 70s Fleetwood Mac Sunset Strip vibes. And this one, of course, is further along the Pacific Coast Highway, further north and further along the timeline. They're all coming to the big screen or small screen, probably. I think probably TV series. So these are ones to look out for on the small screen as well as on the library shelves. They're going to be lush, bingeable treats for the eyes, for sure. I could just see all those beautiful costumes and settings. Now, Taylor Jenkins Reid is really good at sprinkling Easter eggs and sort of world boarding through her books. So Mick Reaver, the dad in this book, has a bit part in Daisy Jones, and he's actually one of Evelyn Hugo's seven husbands.
Oh. Wow.
And apparently there's some other previous characters in the mix at the party, although I didn't pick those up. But that's me. I was reading too fast. I didn't enjoy this as much as Daisy Jones, but it is a fabulous bit of escapism. It's light but not too fluffy. It doesn't take itself too seriously. It does feel a bit like a parody at times of like an 80s soap opera cross with, say, Sweet Valley High with a little bit more TNA. Santa Barbara, Jackie Collins, yes. For a new generation, I would say. Really not a bad way to spend an afternoon at all. It is very popular, like I said. So, but there's actually lots of copies and they're in lots of different formats and it's a quick read. So, you know, if you haven't, get it on your holds list now and hopefully you'll get it by the end of summer. Definitely it's those end of summer vibes.
Yeah. Oh, it's fabulous. I'm just thinking of the hairstyles, actually.
Oh, yeah. Yes. It's hairstyles.
You got me at hair. Oh, brilliant. Yeah. Oh, fabulous. Well, look, I've been reading also an American book, but one that's probably more serious and perhaps more thought-provoking. And it's a graphic novel just published called The Secret to Superhuman Strength by the famous Alison Bechdel. And so it's available in hard copy in our adult graphic novel section, but also as an Overdrive/Libby ebook. So I have enjoyed this so much. So now, for those that don't know, Alison Bechdel is an acclaimed graphic memoirist. I can't say that word today.
Yeah.
I should have practiced that, but I didn't. I am sorry. So anyway, she writes memoirs, and this is her third graphic memoir. And, you know, on a personal note, or to be honest, I think this one's her best, actually. She's written in this book a deeply layered personal story about selfhood, self-sabotage, which is a big deal for a lot of people, mortality, addiction, bliss, wonderment, and the concerns of a generation. Now, I must point out that she was a child in the 1960s and 1970s. So it's quite an extraordinary chronicle. It's very funny and it's very sad. And it's about the conundrums that we all grapple with as we look for our true place in the world. So now, and I didn't know this about Alison Bechdel, but all her life she'd been searching for an elusive secret, and it's the secret to superhuman strength. Mm. And she's looked for it in her favourite books, the lives of her heroes. She tried celibacy, she's tried polyamory, activism, therapy, and in an obsessive way, she's looked for it in exercise. Mm. So she illustrates and writes about skiing, running, karate, cycling, yoga, weightlifting, the Jane Fonda workouts of the 80s.
Oh, I remember those.
Yeah, you name it, though, she's tried it. But what she's discovering, and a lot of people will relate to this, as she's getting older, her body isn't getting any stronger. And the world, she's finding it's overwhelming, it's changing. So she starts to ask herself, and this is a quote, are cantaloupe-sized guns all the person needs? So do we need arms that look like watermelons? I don't know. Perhaps we do. So also, and this is something that as a lot of people will relate to. Even though Alison Bechdel had been a hugely successful graphic novelist for decades, really, in her mid-50s, she's begun suffering from a real sense of dread, and she began asking herself where her creative joy had gone. And I won't tell you what happens, but she's fine, or she gets on a path and to find out what she's actually seeking, but not where she expected that she might find it. So, hint, hasn't got a lot to do with Jane Fonda's 1980s workouts.
More's the pity? No.
But it's really interesting. She recounts the sort of exercise fads that have swept the Western world for decades, from the early days of the guru worship of Charles Atlas, through running, you know, when that became a thing, biking, hiking, feminist martial arts, which I'd never heard of, yoga, mountain climbing. And she says about herself, "I have haired off after almost every new fitness fad to come down the pike for the last six decades." So it made me start to think, I wonder if she's got into those leggings, you know, the leggings that change your life. But, of course, this book is about much more than just exercise, really. Her work always sort of encompasses multiple interlocking themes, and she there's a lot about her emerging gay consciousness, the connection between nature and inner meaning, a lot about the transcendentalists, who were hippies in the 1800s.
Yeah.
And she compares her own pilgrimage to that of Margaret Fuller, who was, in the 1800s, one of the most important American feminists of her day, philosopher, journalist, literary critic. And I learned a lot about that New England intellectual community, who were known as the Transcendentalists, who included Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry David Thoreau, who I was just mentioning to you earlier. With his Walden. She also compares her story a bit to Jack Kerouac, and his stories become really entwined in these pages with Bechdel's story. But it's just beautifully done. Her huge intelligence and real self-deprecating humour, they sort of shimmer, actually, through these beautifully expressive drawings. And there's so much that's going on in the book. She's got the family stuff. Her parents had a very interesting and tragic time of it. There's professional, there's romantic, cultural, spiritual, all the sort of stuff that's happening. You can really see how she did become overwhelmed, and how she's had to learn to accept her looming mortality, you know, the thing that's waiting down the crack for all of us. And so she decides to just stop the struggle. And, you know, that decision is one that seems so simple, doesn't it? And yet it's one of the hardest things that we can do. So it's thought-provoking. It's absolutely beautiful. I think she's a really important creator, but what I loved about this this graphic novel compared to her others, or memoir, I should say, graphic memoir, the divine illustrations, they're coloured this time with a beautiful watercolour wash. It's quite vibrant and inviting, and actually I discovered later that it's actually her partner who did the colouring in, or the watercolours, and you can sort of see the love that's in those illustrations. So
beautiful.
I'd really recommend this one. It's really something, and it gives you a good potted history of where we've been and where we're going.
Last 50 years, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Well, look, once again, I think we've run out of time. So really just want to say thanks so much for tuning in to everyone. Take care and be kind to yourselves. Haere rā, ka kite anō.